Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back Laurel Sisler, great guest co-host from UNC Family Medicine. Welcome, Laurel.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to actually also have a great conversation with today Dr. Margaret Helton and Dr. Tim Dalton from the University of North Carolina Family Medicine Department about their new book, Chronic Illness Care, Principles in Practice, an important new book about how to really teach and take care of people with chronic illness. You see a lot of patients with chronic illness over UNC Family Medicine.
I do, yeah. I'm getting looking forward to talking with them about their new book.
Yeah. First, though, we have some interesting research that matters, and let's dive right in. And the first research is about autism risk and whether it matters about what the mom eats or the health of her gut. I find this an interesting research.
I do as well, because it impacts so many families. They're talking about this gut microbiome, which is such a common term these days. But really, it's the health of the gut and what good bacteria are in your gut. And looking at a study in mice in particular, where they impacted the pregnant mom's diet and then looked at the likelihood of the offspring developing autism.
Yeah. And these particular mice, they actually were able to block an inflammatory module that or molecules that actually can block these natural occurring microbiomes that affect the immune system. It was this molecule, interleukin 17A, they were able to potentially change how these lab mice, what happened with them. And it raises the question about if you could target the maternal microbiome or ultimately do things that affect this interleukin 17A, which might be tricky in pregnant individuals because that molecule is responsible for lots of things, but you might be able to help identify a subset of people who might be at higher risk for autism and may be able to prevent it.
Yeah, I think that's the positive side. Another way of looking at it is also just, oh gosh, it's another thing for pregnant moms to think about. But the positive is certainly that we might be able to prevent issues in their children.
Yeah. We also know that diet plays a good role in the microbiome, that probiotics may play a role in the microbiome. So there's some other ways of thinking about how one may go about doing things that ultimately would be kind of low cost, low risk, that may improve, particularly if there's some risk perhaps of autism that in a family or people want to lower their chances. It certainly can't hurt.
Definitely can't hurt.
We're a long way away from prime time on these things. Let's talk about the next research that matters that raises no questions. It's a tragedy across the United States, probably across the world, but it's about the police killings of people of color that we know have been happening at an alarming rate in ways that actually are structural and institutional racism in many cases. This is what this research is about.
Yeah, it's really important research. So it was a survey data of over 100,000 Black adults between 2013 and 2015, and looking at how frequently they reported their mental health as not good in the previous month. So on average, they reported about 4.1 days of poor mental health, and there was an uptick in that with every single incidence of police violence, particularly in the month or two following the killing.
And they didn't see this same uptick in the killing of non-Blacks, and so you didn't see that in white patients. And we know that on average, African-Americans are exposed to 4 police killings in their state each year. And this research would suggest that there's really a adverse medical impact that can be measured among the population of African-Americans from being exposed to this. This makes this even larger and worse for something that was already large and bad.
Yeah, and for people who need data to understand this issue, this seems to add that important data.
And hopefully it allows us to begin to have this conversation about how to reduce this toxic stress, how to reduce this traumatic experiences, how to really figure out better mechanisms across society. I think talking about it is a first step, but it's not by any means the last step, and many more steps to be done. Let's talk about our last research that matters, and it's about screen time and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. I really think this is there's something there, so to speak, that this is something relating to the amount of different stimuli that comes at our teens, that the more that this happens, the more they may well be hyperactive.
Yeah,
am I worried necessarily?
I don't think so. This hits close to home. I was just having a conversation with friends the other night about setting a deadline at nighttime to remove the phones and not bringing phones into the bedroom. And just it's important to have that protective screen-free time. And this study is looking at the impact of those screens on high school students. So it's 2,500 high school students in Los Angeles, and they tracked them, followed them for 2 years, looking at their screen time habits and then their likelihood of developing ADHD. And there was a 10%
increased chance
for those who had reported frequent screen time use.
Yeah, this was in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And, you know, depending on how much they were on digital activities, texting, streaming videos, music, social media, the more they were on them, the more likely they were to develop this hyperactivity by the end of the study compared to those who really didn't do any of these activities frequently, and much fewer of those developed. And none of these kids had this before the study. So we do know that things like sitting down and watching the television for hours and hours are actually linked to attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. We can now believe, I think, increasingly that this social media, the more you're hit with so many different stimuli, the more difficult it may be to stay with one thing over a prolonged period of time. Something I think our parents need to hear, and maybe all of us need to hear, as you indicate. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, Laurel and I are going to be talking with Dr. Margaret Helton and Dr. Tim Dahlman from the University of North Carolina Family Medicine Department about their new book, Chronic Illness Care, Principles in Practice. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Laurel Sisler. Stay with us. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Laurel Sisler. Today on Conversations, Laurel, we actually had the pleasure of talking with several of our colleagues at the University of North Carolina Family Medicine's Department, Dr. Margaret Helton and Dr. Tim Dahlman, about a really important new book they've written called Chronic Illness Care, Principles in Practice. Welcome, Dr. Helton and Dr. Dahlman.
Thank you, Adam.
Thank you.
You know, it's such a pleasure. I think we probably have had each of you on the show at different times over the last 10 years for different reasons, but never together and never about a topic really that's probably critical to almost every listener in the United States. And before we really dive into the book, maybe say in a couple sentences a little bit about how both of you really kind of came to a place where you were so interested in chronic disease and chronic illness.
I think the patient sort of brought us there, or brought me there specifically. And in looking at the genesis for this book, the way that we care for patients has really changed in the last 20, 25 years. And I think in the past it was just how do you master certain kinds of materials, knowledge base, et cetera. And now with a lot of different changes at multiple different levels, whether looking at how do you work within teams? How do you look within a larger healthcare system as well? It really sort of changed at least my perspective and my understanding of what the needs are out there for multiple different learners, whether you're a medical student or a resident or even somebody who's been in practice for a number of years, and not just physicians but also the people that actually are part of the team, allied health, nursing, et cetera as well. So that really was the genesis for thinking about this text.
I think we also were motivated by what we saw around us. You're right. Most textbooks are about clinical medicine. But in the Family Medicine Center at UNC, we've been very innovative over the last few years to change the paradigm of care. Care traditionally over the last 50 years or more has been centered around acute illness, a surgical emergency, an infection, something that has a clear beginning and end. And that's no longer the case. Now the majority of healthcare is chronic disease, and that's because people are living a long time. The average lifespan has increased by decades over the last 20 to 30 years. And so people are living with chronic diseases for a long time. And so in the Family Medicine Center, we have all these innovations about how do you change the way we provide care. And that means we have team-based care. We have more input from pharmacists. We have social workers helping us more. We have to reorganize the system of care. And so we saw all this around us and know that everybody is struggling to adjust to this new paradigm in healthcare, and that was one of the motivations to write about it.
Yeah, what a great motivation there, and an important story to tell with the changes in healthcare over the last 20, 30 years. So you mentioned chronic illness several times. If you could just back up for a second and tell our listeners exactly what you mean by that, if you have a definition.
Well, it's not necessarily our definition. I think when we think about chronic illness, it's something that has some temporal or time component, generally lasting for more than 3 months. It's not a type of disease or illness state that's going to resolve or sort of go away by itself by medication, and has some sort of long-lasting chronic pattern or sequelae that are there as well. And so, you know, as Margaret was sort of mentioning, there really has been a shift, I think, over the last century from acute episodes of largely infectious disease to things that really have gone on with more of a temporal or a time component that's there as well.
So a classic example would be diabetes, high blood pressure, just scores of illnesses, rheumatologic diseases, even cancer, even HIV. These are not short-term conditions. They are long-term conditions that are managed over years, if not decades.
So let's talk about certain elements. And I want to talk about one, Dr. Helen, I know that's near and dear to you. It's geriatric medicine. I'll be disclosing certain things today. Our listeners should know you took care of my mother. Thank you very much when she was alive. I really appreciate that care when she moved here and was in need of geriatric care by a primary care doctor. What qualifies as the sorts of things that you feel, let's say, in a geriatric population are important for this chronic illness? What's different about that type of care today than perhaps we wouldn't have seen 10 and 20 years ago? I kind of know some of it because, like, I needed to access a social worker lots of times, and 20 years ago, that wouldn't have been very easy.
Well, first of all, I have to tell your listeners what a wonderful son you were to your mother. You could not have done more for her. But to answer your question, in caring for older adults, there's a lot of special considerations. So, for example, more is not always better. And so there needs to be discerning what is actually helpful for this person and what is not. It's really easy to harm older adults by interventions, by medications. And so we can't reflexively do the same thing for somebody who's 85 as maybe for somebody who's 25, because there might be side effects and just other considerations, not to mention what the individual, him or herself, would like as far as, you know, I don't want to say aggressiveness in a way, but in a way that's a good word. Not everybody wants everything done. And kind of hand in hand with chronic care is this whole idea of evidence-based care or quality care, finding care that actually benefits the person rather than just doing something because we know how to do it.
And actually, Dr. Dahlman, Dr. Helton mentioned something about kind of like things that you may not do differently or you may do differently, like end-of-life care. I know that you have a strong interest in end-of-life care. I know you have a chapter in the book on end-of-life care. Help us understand how then does that really take place, because I don't recall in my textbooks of medical school where there was a whole chapter on end-of-life care. It was maybe a paragraph in another chapter.
You know, part of, I guess, our first reorientation is thinking this is a long continuum. And I think for a lot of clinicians, patients, people in healthcare think of end-of-life care as sort of a very fixed time, sort of at those last few hours or moments. And hopefully within the book is how do you think of this more longitudinally? A lot of those components that go to end-of-life care, whether it's talking about advanced care planning, a lot of the issues that Dr. Helton was talking about is how do you think about the wishes of the individual, the family? How do you begin to put together different types of care plans that match the needs and the desires of the individual and also the family that's there as well? So I think that in addition to the advancements of symptom management, so when people are having pain or they're having some difficulty with some shortness of breath, but largely how do you sort of begin to wrap around those different types of care services? And I guess the takeaway is that this is something that's much more longitudinal, that really should begin earlier on within the course of the disease or the illness that individuals have. And in the past, I think it's been much more pushed towards that end part of the illness course.
You know, you're Dr. Dahlman, you're talking about end of life, and Dr. Helton, you're talking about working with older adults. One question that always comes to my mind is, you know, maybe it used to be that over 65 was the cutoff for an older adult. It seems that that has been pushed back and back as we live longer and are generally healthier. Is there an age cutoff now, or how do you think about that? Who is an older adult, and you think about the things you were just mentioning?
Well, what we say in geriatrics is an older adult is anybody who's more than 10 years older than I am. So that's what all geriatricians will answer. But, you know, Medicare starts at 65. So there's a lot of sort of built-in assumptions that at 65, you are now an older adult or you now need to see a geriatrician or some. And so indeed, 65 is getting younger and younger. But in all reality, 65-year-olds, 75-year-olds, many of them enjoy excellent health and are living the way people used to live when they were 40. So we've really pushed the age limit up as far as how active and healthy people are. And I have patients who are 95 who are as sharp as a tack. So it's not clear when somebody reaches that what you would call a geriatric age because there's tremendous variation among individuals.
Yeah. Well, we'll be certain not to label anyone that doesn't want to be labeled, Doug, because I know if you're 85 and you feel like the being elderly is 90, that's perfectly okay.
Yeah, we'll go with that.
But we're going to take a short break. But when we return, we're going to continue talking with the University of North Carolina's Family Medicine's Dr. Margaret Helton and Dr. Tim Dahlman about their new book, Chronic Illness Care, Principles and Practice. We'll be right back with your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Laurel Sisler. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health Radio, and we're talking with UNC Family Medicine's Dr. Margaret Helton and Dr. Tim Dahlman about their new book, Chronic Illness, Principles and Practice. One thing I'd love to hear from both of you is maybe one or two things that you learned through writing this book from the contributions of all of the other authors, because it was more than just you two. There were 10, 20 writers involved in this collaboration.
I guess that was the fun part for me is, you know, identifying potential authors and Margaret and I sort of sitting down and looking both within our department across our medical school and then nationally to identify, you know, once we decided on these topics. And the one that really sort of surprised me was the information technology chapter that was there. Because again, part of this is how do you begin to think about this if you're a clinician, if you're somebody who's working within that around some of the different challenges around working with an electronic health record or with different types of technology that are sort of coming down. And Carl Moore, who wrote that, who is actually a general internist within the Department of Medicine, really expanded that. And I learned a lot of how much that has really changed the shape of what we're doing within healthcare. A lot of the national news that you're sort of seeing these days around some of the changes within reimbursement, et cetera, and how much of that was tied to a lot of the economic factors that went on with the recession back in 2008. I mean, a lot of the impetus and a lot of the changes in encouraging physicians' practices, hospitals to do that. And for me, that was a surprising thing. I thought I was going to come away with just a better understanding of how to work with my own electronic health record. But really, it was an education for me of just the historical and some of the future states in looking at HIT.
Yeah, I would echo that some of the most fascinating things that I learned were about the larger policy implications of chronic disease. So in particular, I found it really interesting to learn about the various payment models that are being proposed in the future. How is that going to change Medicare, other insurance payments as we shift toward value-based care?
Do you have an example of one of those new payment models that may be on the horizon?
Well, one of the challenges is that the payment model that we've had for more than 50 years is fee-for-service. And so as a physician then, or the healthcare system, the physician makes more money the more you come to the doctor. And so if you have diabetes, there's no financial incentive for me to keep you healthy. Because if you come in because your toe needs amputation, because you have vascular disease, your kidneys are failure, so you need dialysis, you need to go in the hospital a lot because your diabetes is not controlled, all of that generates income for the healthcare system. And that's what we call a perverse incentive. There's no financial incentive for the physician to keep you healthy. In a new system of care, we'll have what we call value-based care, and that is that physicians and others in healthcare are only going to be paid for interventions that are proven to be of value. So that's the guiding principle, and what that means in reality is that there might be something called capitated care. So rather than me as your doctor being paid every time you come to the doctor with this or that problem, I'm going to be told that I have this much payment for your care over the next year. And if I want to do sloppy care and make your care really expensive because I'm not helping you keep your diabetes under control, then I'm not going to get any extra money for that. I'm going to lose money.
Yeah.
But yet if we team as the patient and the provider say, look, we are really going to get your diabetes under control and your kidneys are going to be healthier, your toes are going to be healthier, your heart's going to be healthier, and we're going to keep you out of the hospital. In fact, we're even going to keep you out of the doctor's office because we'll do this electronically or something like that. Then we're going to have tremendous cost savings. And, you know, ethically, that shouldn't be the motivation, cost savings. It should be that the motivation is taking good care of you. But that's not always been the way it's been. And so this is a chance for a new paradigm to be beneficial in many ways.
Dr. Dahmer, let me ask you a question. Because, you know, when we think about, in the title of the book, chronic illness care, a lot of patients come in with acute problems still, and they come in to the hospital with acute problems. And you have a chapter in your book on acute hospital care. Well, first off, why is that chapter in the book? Do we care about that? And then how do we structure chronic care around this idea that people do a lot of what they come in with is, and maybe in their own minds, they think, I've got a sore throat, I just need that treated.
I think that's an important distinction, you know, and part of the chapters, or I should say part of the section that we have for the acute hospitalizations, there are multiple different sites of chronic illness care. I think the misassumption this only happens within doctor's offices, this only happens within clinical settings. It happens across, as I said, the continuum of nursing homes, of assisted livings, of rehabilitation centers, and also particularly within hospitalizations as well. Because I would sort of assume or sort of guarantee the events that led up to that acute hospitalization, whether it's having an acute heart attack or having a stroke, et cetera, there were precursors that could have been addressed earlier. Smoking cessation, weight management, all those kinds of health behaviors that in the context of different settings Within the hospital, I think most of us sort of draw our attention to those acute events of how do we begin to manage those types of adverse symptoms, et cetera. And also, there are systems in place within hospital settings as well. So, for example, you know, right now, I think if you're admitted to many hospitals, how do you begin to look at are there preventive services that are offered? What percentage of patients, although you may be coming in with a different problem, do you receive your pneumococcal, your shot for preventing pneumonia that's there? So looking at that. So also it sort of triggers different what are called bundles. So if you're having symptoms that are suggestive of having a very severe infection, again, there are things that alert the emergency department that says, have you done X, Y, and Z? Have you gotten antibiotics on board? Have you given them IV fluids, which are evidence-based types of approaches that are there? So a lot of the principles, and that's the reason we sort of title that both principles and practice, cut across some of those different care settings, whether you're in the hospital setting, whether you're in an outpatient doctor's office, whether you're in a nursing home, et cetera.
So maybe think about a medicine that you should have been on that you weren't on when you came in the hospital, or maybe a medicine that you needed to stop that you were on. So to think more broadly in the face, I love it.
I think the key thing around that is that the onus is not just on the individual physician or provider that's there. So how do you begin to look at from a system standpoint, whether it's embedding it with an electronic health record or queuing in nursing staff that's there that sort of go through an inventory of different preventive services that are needed. So people that have diabetes and making sure that they've had their eye exams, making sure they've had their foot exams, et cetera. Or even when a patient first hits the emergency department and they're meeting with the triage nurse, the nurse recognizes certain types of vital signs and says, hey, this patient is getting septic. We need to activate this protocol to make sure that they get the care delivered at the right time.
Right care at the right time. Thinking about our listeners, what advice do you have for them if they are facing a chronic illness themselves or maybe a loved one? What would you tell them?
And don't everyone speak up at once. Great
question. We're pausing because there's so many different kinds of chronic illnesses. They affect all ages. In fact, we have a chapter in here on chronic illness in children. So it would just depend on what that is. But as always, patients should play active roles in their health care. So good communication. You know, the current paradigm of healthcare is that you and your provider are a team working together. We're no longer working under a paternalistic model where the doctor will tell you what to do and make the decisions for you. This really is a team. And that's one thing that we'll pursue with chronic care is better systems of communication. And that might be something like, you know, reporting your sugars online to the nurse every week and then getting feedback through a patient electronic portal. So just be informed and be participatory in your care team. You know, you're a member of the care team as well.
Yeah, to build upon that, there's a whole system, I guess, behind, and the days of just having an individual provider, physician, nurse are long gone. And don't just look at your individual physician or look at your individual provider as a sole source of your care. And so whether it's a care manager, there's a lot of people that are behind the scenes that are there as well. The pharmacist who may come in and help you reconcile your medication that's there. The pharmacist at the local outpatient pharmacy that may give you your pneumonia or your influenza shot that's there. So again, you know, look at this in a much more systematic function. How do you begin to engage in different means of communication? Also, what are your goals in looking at this long, it's a long-term endeavor when you've got a chronic illness. What's important to you? Because I think a lot of times, I think we as providers, as physicians get sort of caught up in the day-to-day types of things that we miss the longer term. What's important to you in terms of your quality of life? How do you want to be cared for? Because those are things that begin to impact the systems that happen downstream.
On behalf of your health, we really want to thank you for providing the leadership of what is clearly a team-based effort to put this book together, and the hope and belief that this infuses and diffuses to providers across the country who interact with patients and help maybe kind of demystify some of the more complex areas within the healthcare system for your health listeners. Thank you both for being our guests today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Dr. Tim Dahlman and Dr. Margaret Helton of the University of North Carolina Family Medicine Department about their new book, Chronic Illness Care, Principles and Practice. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Laurel Sisler. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And Laura, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
My wife and I are in our mid-30s and have just begun trying to have a baby. She and her OBGYN have had several conversations about this since we've passed that 35-year-old mark, but I'm wondering if there's anything that, as a man, I should consider as we begin the process.
Well, I think that's a great question. We don't frequently think as much about how the man can try to help increase the chances of pregnancy by having healthy sperm. Certainly, obesity is certainly related to a lower sperm quality production. Also, smoking. Smoking is strongly related to these things. And just lifestyle, thinking about what other lifestyle sorts of things that are really bad for, you know, anyone, but certainly people trying to get pregnant. Heavy alcohol use would be there. Things you wouldn't think about, like bug sprays. So, you know, spraying bug sprays on if you're trying to get it may decrease because they may have some absorption of that. Serious illnesses that could be there. And then certain prescriptions, just like for women, there may be prescriptions that would be contraindicated if you're trying to get pregnant. And there would be certain things for men as well. So I think you would want to talk with your doctor if you're taking prescription medications about whether they may affect sperm motility, sperm quality, sperm amount. Any other thoughts?
I don't know that I have anything else to add other than just supporting your partner.
Yeah. Thank you for that great question. Laura, what's our very next house call?
A few weeks ago, I happened to see my nephew hanging out with some friends, and they were all vaping. I have a feeling that my brother has no idea that my nephew's tried this. Is vaping habit-forming, and should I talk to my nephew or my brother about what I saw?
The vaping police.
Right?
Oh, no. Yeah. Well, you know what? This is a really important question, and it's one that Laurel and I actually deal with daily through the work we do with adolescents and adults who are using electronic cigarettes or vaping other products.
Yeah, and it's on the rise. Vaping and electronic cigarette use is rapidly increasing among our young teenagers and young adults. It's an important topic. A couple things I think of, and you probably have some to add, Adam, is A, if they're vaping, they may also be experimenting with cigarette use, which we know is very harmful, that vaping in and of itself can be, if it has nicotine, which the vast majority of them do, can be really damaging to the adolescent brain. So those are some of the concerns that I have right off the bat.
Yeah, I think kids will not necessarily believe that vaping is harmful. Whether it's less harmful than cigarette smoking really isn't the question, because for a lot of them, it may be a gateway, as you indicate, Laurel, to using combustible tobacco, or they may put marijuana in as a vaping, or they may even be vaping opiates, and that becomes a whole different issue. There are toxic metals that they are going to be exposed to. There are burns that they can be exposed to, the batteries from these products. There's a whole host of things, and we just don't know. So the biggest thing is to really talk with them, talk with the child, let them know the data, open up the conversation. I think it's an open conversation. It's not a police conversation. We don't want to criminalize this habit, but we do want to let the kids know and the nephew know that this could be the prelude to a nicotine addiction.
Yep.
Not a good thing, is it?
No. And just, I agree. Have an open conversation and asking questions, getting them to think about the potential risks and starting the conversation that way.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
I've begun to eat a pescatarian diet, which of course means that my fish intake has gone way up recently. What are the best fish for me to eat, and which one should I only eat in moderation?
Well, in general, we think most pescatarian diets are healthy for patients. You're having less meat, processed meats, and more fish products. That's in general the type of fats that are good for one. So, Laura, what sort of things do you have?
Exactly. I think in general, it's a really good thing. You're getting lots of healthy fats and other nutrients. There are a couple of fish and shellfish that are lower in mercury, which I think is what the question is asking about. And so the ones that are lower that you can eat more frequently are things like shrimp and salmon and catfish. And the ones that are really quite high in mercury is going to be your bigger fish, like your shark meat or your swordfish or king mackerel or the white tuna that is quite popular right now.
So even those the blue ones, fish I've heard at times. So it's kind of the more oily, sometimes the darker even aspects. But those ones that could be higher in mercury, that you really should limit the amount that you have.
Right. More like one small serving a week.
Yeah. And certainly being broiled rather than fried would be good.
True. We're putting on our good public health hat.
Butter.
Yes.
Right? Good things. Even though the butter tastes good. Yep. Lemon's really good.
Lemon is good on fish and dill and all sorts of.
Let's ask our health science librarians to maybe put a couple healthy pescatarian recipes on our website. Laura, what's our very last house call?
I was recently diagnosed with leukemia by my primary care doctor, and over the last 6 weeks, I've seen some really great specialists, including an oncologist and a hematologist, among others. I do wonder, however, who is the quarterback of my healthcare team at this point? At what point do I need to call my primary care doctor and check in?
Well, first off, we're sorry to hear of the diagnosis. What a life-changing event to be diagnosed with a disease like leukemia. That's a difficult diagnosis. On the other hand, it's so great that you're doing well. And a lot of patients really do well because the drugs, the ways we understand to treat it have gotten so much better from the last two decades. So that part's really great.
Yeah, and thinking about who's the quarterback of your team, I think that it sounds like you're in treatment right now, in which case for your leukemia, the hematologist-oncologist would be the quarterback of your cancer treatment. But thinking about other issues that might come up, you might consult your primary care if, Adam, you probably have examples on top of mind of when to really bring that primary care doctor in.
Yeah, a lot of patients will have diabetes and high blood pressure, and all those things still cause problems. So if you were to get chest pain, for instance, you may be having an infusion of a drug, but whether it's that drug that's causing the problem or your underlying disease that's causing that problem, it's not so straightforward. You may have swelling in your legs. Is that a clot from the cancer? Is that from the drug being used to treat the cancer? Or is it unrelated to either and related to just excess fluid in the legs, maybe heart failure again? So these are complicated things. I think a lot of times patients need two quarterbacks. Maybe it's a quarterback and the running back here. You can't have a team that just has a quarterback. The star of the team can be the team rather than the individual players here because you really need someone who's accessible. So it may even be less about the person than the accessibility, being able to get a question answered to say, who should I contact and get that question answered. Your primary care physician might say, you know, this would be so, if you could directly talk to your oncologist, I'm happy to send them a note too. Maybe harder to get in touch with the oncologist than the primary care physician.
It might be. And then thinking about who you have a longer-term relationship with. If it is one of these more chronic, long-term issues like diabetes or hypertension, maybe your primary care doctor knows more about that and knows you and would be a better person to address those questions.
Well, we want to thank you for joining us today for your health. That'll conclude our house calls, and we hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to your health. You can share any question or story by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit online at yourhealthradio.org and follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or search for our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank my great guest co-host, Laurel Sisler, and our guests today, Dr. Margaret Helton and Dr. Tim Dahlman. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
I'm Laurel Sisler.
And we look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.